Morning again. So we're going to consider our reading first from the book of John, our gospel reading, and then our reading from the book of Acts. And to get things started, I would call this a tale of two skeptics. The twist, though, is that one of the skeptics I think I would characterize as very reasonable. And I probably would have the same level of skepticism. And then the other, I would say that his skepticism is characterized as being incredibly wise. And I see a couple of people going, huh? Excellent. That's where I want you to be. First, we'll turn to Thomas. And if you noticed in the reading, Thomas was not there when Jesus first appeared. And Jesus talked to his disciples, showed them the scars, said a bunch of things to them. And as you might imagine, they seem quite excited. But where was Thomas? Well, in reality, we don't know. The closest we can get to answering that question is by asking what would cause Thomas not to take some kind of refuge or solace with his brothers that he's traveled with for maybe about 3 years, learning under Jesus. There aren't any ways that we, again, can know for sure, but reasonably speaking, you isolate yourself when you have no hope. And it seems to me that Thomas just ran out of hope. And that squares with what little we know about Thomas. Earlier during Jesus' ministry, Jesus is about to go into Jerusalem, and some other religious leaders who actually seem to be on Jesus' side said, hey, not a good idea. There are people there trying to kill you. And Jesus' response is, if I may just put my own, or retranslate, Jesus' response is, so? And then he goes to Jerusalem. And Thomas was the one who responded by saying, well, let's go and die with him. Giving us maybe a little window into his personality. Maybe he's a little reckless. He's not as reckless as Peter is, thankfully. But that's not something that you would say lightly. And so for Thomas to have lost Jesus may have been more devastating than the others. I don't know. But can you imagine from his vantage point, he finally makes his way back to his brothers and they say, hey, we saw Jesus. No, you didn't. That level of skepticism is perfectly reasonable. I mean, if somebody were to have died and then somebody comes and tells you, hey, I saw that person, you would have one of two questions. Are you well? Like, just in general, is there a medical issue? Do we need to seek emergency medical care or something like that? Or are you so overcome with grief that your mind is doing very strange things, which can happen? Thomas has no reason to suspect that Jesus has been raised. Nobody, in fact, really expected Jesus to be raised, because nobody expected the Messiah to be raised, because nobody expected the Messiah to die. And so Thomas there with his brothers, essentially, he says, look, you're going to have to, I can't go just based on your word. And I think we would all have the same exact response if there was someone that we know to have been who has died, and then suddenly some people are saying, well, no, that person's alive again. We'd say, no, unless I actually see them, I'm not going to believe. And don't show me any pictures or video because it's all AI these days anyway. Anyway. And while his skepticism, I think, is extremely reasonable, is a very natural response. I find it incredibly telling that Jesus has no issue with meeting Thomas where he's at. He's not offended. He's not mad. He's perfectly understanding. I mean, after all, he is Jesus. And so given the opportunity, he then gives what he gave to the other disciples to Thomas. He says, all right, if you, I get it. Here are my scars. Do you now believe that it's me? Now, that's enough for Thomas. I think I would be deeply disturbed, and I would need longer than Thomas took. I think that's true for probably a bunch of us. I have had the experience, I've talked about it before, where a former classmate of mine at seminary had heard through a rumor through the grapevine that I had died. I kid you not. And so when he saw me on a bus as we were at a conference, that poor guy was not okay for a while. And yeah, his name is Chris, and it was really funny. But he was talking to me, and just the whole time, just very uncomfortable. And he finally said, I heard you died of leukemia. I was like, no, that wasn't me. But what I find so helpful with Jesus meeting Thomas where he's at is that Jesus doesn't feel the need to condemn doubt. So maybe we shouldn't either. As a pastor of however many years now, math is hard, I'll figure that out later. I've noticed that the doubts that people have typically are not simply academic and intellectual. When people experience doubt within their faith, it's usually due to other circumstances. Life hits like a truck, because it does. Or the old saying, and I'll probably come back to this, that, look, I like Jesus, it's his fan club that makes me a little uncomfortable. I get it. And so the most appropriate way to walk with somebody in their doubt is to simply be present. Jesus doesn't feel the need to condemn them, so maybe we shouldn't either. And maybe even more importantly, why would we condemn ourselves when we experience some of those same doubts? What we ultimately have in this moment as Jesus interacts with Thomas is a level of kindness and tenderness and just presence in those hard moments. It's very reasonable to suspect that Thomas just endured one of the worst weekends of his life. So Jesus simply offers what he needs. And then with an eye to the future, he says, hey, you're blessed because you see and you've believed. Imagine those who are coming after you who have not seen, and yet they're still going to believe. And if faith were simply up to us, that would be an almost impossible task. But I think the real gift is that faith is a gift. Sometimes that gift does not make sense. Have you ever been given a gift where you've said, thanks, I don't know what to do with this? Maybe sometimes faith is like that. Jesus in his grace and kindness gives us this gift, and then for the rest of our lives, we'll figure out how that works. I'm good with that. That's the life of being a disciple. The second skeptic, if you will, is a man named Gamaliel from our Acts reading. And just by way of setup, Jesus has gone through and met with his disciples many times, and he's taught them, and he's ascended to heaven where he has taken the throne. He has sent the Holy Spirit, and the church just starts to explode all over the place. And ultimately, this creates conflict because this is all happening in Jerusalem, which is the place where the temple, the place of God's residence, is. And it was the chief priests, the highest ranking priests, who we know from all kinds of other sources from the first century, were absolute charlatans, who were incredibly greedy and made a ton of money in the process. And when the revolution came in the next generation, they were the first against the wall, as you'd expect. And so if they were the ones responsible ultimately for Jesus' death, which they were, they suddenly have a whole bunch of people saying, hey, that guy, that Nazarene, he was alive. We saw him, and he has come to us in a very special way, and now their movement grows. God has done something incredible. It is a new era of resurrection, the defeat of death, the forgiveness of sins, a return from exile. God is going to now slowly restore his creation, and he's beginning with the hearts of his people. And guess what? It's those guys over there, those temple elites that we all can't stand, they're the ones that got him killed. You can imagine that they're not going to love that, to put it mildly. And so the first several chapters of the book of Acts is them trying to snuff this whole movement out, and it does not work. And so they come to this moment with Gamaliel, and it's Peter and John. For the first while, it's always them. And Gamaliel, in his wisdom, and he was known for being incredibly wise, ushers them out of the room, saying, let's have a little conversation off the table. Now, obviously, somebody talked. Now, Gamaliel was known for being wise. He is one of the most revered of the Jewish sages, not just from that period, but from all time. His grandfather, Hillel the Great, is all of modern Judaism descends from him. It's basically Moses, Hillel. And he carries on that legacy, wildly respected in his time and later. You can read about him if you want, if you're really bored. But nonetheless, he points out that there have been a couple of times in recent memory that leaders have emerged essentially claiming to be the Messiah, the Holy One, who is going to usher in this new era for Israel and vindicate God's people, kick the Roman authorities out, reform the temple, so on and so forth. Now, I am going to try really hard to control my impulse to get deeply nerdy about the two movements that he mentions. I just want you to know that there are some really cool things underneath the surface. We'll talk about them sometime. But he mentions these two, and he says, we know what happened with them. Their leader was killed, and eventually their movement just died out. Which means, on the one hand, Gamaliel suspects that's going to happen with this. He said, look, the leader is dead. Let these guys play out, because they're probably just going to lose steam and, you know, forget it. And then he says, but if this movement actually endures, maybe it's actually from God. And we probably shouldn't actively work against them, because we'll be working against God. So let's just leave them be. Aside from all of the other things that Gamaliel's comment is, it's very wise, because if you want to just ensure that a movement really starts thriving, put some pressure on it. It's like a really obstinate teenager. If you don't want them to go to, you know, do certain things or whatever, like, start getting real strict and see what happens. At least that was the case for me. my parents are no longer able to watch this. They're traveling, so they won't know. I don't think. We'll see if they call me. He's saying, first off, it's kind of like that. And then in his wisdom, there's a certain openness to the fact that maybe God is really doing something here. I don't know. And that's exactly the kind of characteristic sort of openness and gentleness that he would have gotten from his grandfather Hillel. Fascinatingly enough, and this is the one time, hopefully this morning, where my impulse control will take will just die. Gamaliel had one student who is just head and shoulders more famous than all of his others. Out of curiosity, can anyone name him? Yeah, Paul. It came from over there. I couldn't locate it. Yeah, Paul, St. Paul. He says he studied at the feet of Gamaliel, and if you know anything about the story of Paul, his early years, he regrets because he was hunting this movement down, which leads to another question of why is the student so unlike the teacher? I'll leave you with that to just marinate. But nevertheless, Gamaliel's skepticism is both wise and justified. He's seen this before, or they've seen this, to some extent. People will come and go. There were about a dozen of these movements on either side of Jesus' life. What they had not seen before is the claim that after their guy got killed, he came back. That's new. And that's a really bold claim. And just like Thomas going, no, I don't buy it unless I actually see him. We can at least say that Gamaliel's response is reasonable. People don't raise from the dead. Dead people stay dead. That's just kind of how it works. That's the tragedy of it all. Now, we don't know what happens with Gamaliel after that. We don't know if, you know, 20 years later, let's say, I think he died like in the mid-50s. We don't know if he had a chance to look at the way that this movement was spreading all throughout the Mediterranean world, at which point maybe he would have said, oh, there's something behind this. We don't know. But that's how the rest of the story played out. In almost no time at all, you had a group of people living as though God actually raised the dead. And not just that God raised the dead, but this ushered in something different, something new to the rest of the world. That this community of people started living as though when Jesus said, love your neighbor as yourself, and if the question arises, well, then who is my neighbor, which is asking, well, who do I actually have to care about? His response is to tell a story whose punchline is, be the neighbor, don't ask who is your neighbor. And they start actually living as though Jesus meant it when he said it. And these communities started popping up all over the place that, contrary to the rest of their culture, that valued things like power and domination, excessive greed and just sort of no control over your impulses and that kind of thing, and just living however you want, it doesn't matter the carnage that you leave in its wake, that instead we actually care about those, even those on the margins, those who have nothing to offer us, those whom society has sort of shuffled off to the side, those who recognize that there's a certain kind of brokenness within them, those who need help, those who are hungry, those who live with regret and shame. Turns out when there's a community that lives and cares about those people, in other words, that cares about us, well, sign me up. The remarkable thing isn't that we can write out a mathematical proof that God raised Jesus from the dead. I think there's really good and very interesting historical analysis that claims that it's very, very hard, if not impossible, to explain the emergence of the church without beginning with that tomb was empty. And there are some books I can recommend if you're curious. But hearts are not won over by simple proofs. Hearts are won over by people actually caring. And in the case of the church, in its most ideal sense, living in the aftershocks of the resurrection, and then asking, so what do we do now? You love your neighbor. You proclaim the forgiveness of sins, that death doesn't have the final word, that your shame, regret, and guilt that you carry is in fact a lie under the baptism into Jesus' death. And that our history has been filled with moments and communities of people actually just doing this and living and growing in that new reality. At the same time, our history is a little checkered, or very checkered, depending on how you want to look at it. Because as it turns out, the church has been filled with people this entire time, and people are complicated. People often make mistakes. And so there are plenty of times, and I've known so many people that I would consider even very good friends who are very curious about Jesus and very turned off by his fan club, which would be us. But there's that undeniable attraction to somebody like Jesus, who not only instituted this idea that, hey, care for your neighbor, give them what they need, and if you're the one in need, it's okay. That we are all spiritually broken, and Jesus is the one that has made a way toward wholeness. While at the same time, bringing that reality to us. As it turns out, a little bit of skepticism is not a bad thing. If we experience doubts, congratulations, that means you're human. If we find ourselves very much attracted to this guy Jesus, but unsure of what to do with the rest of it, I think you're in the right place. And I think Jesus' response to that, based on his interaction with Thomas and others, would be, what do you need? Because he's there for us. And this isn't just wishful thinking. I think if we were just interested in coming up with this idea, essentially creating God in our own image, God would look very different. In fact, God would start looking a whole lot like us. But that's not how Jesus works. Jesus subverts all attempts to claim power in his name, to claim authority in his name, to justify our actions and deeds based on the things that we want by just claiming this is what Jesus would want. Or in the words of Anne Lamott, you know that you've created God in your own image if you hate all the same people he does. Yeah, think about that one. But the reality is that in Jesus' kindness and tenderness, his willing to give himself up for us, he achieved the one victory none of us could. And it's not by making claims to power, it's not by making claims to authority, but it's by giving himself up for those around him. That's how you change the world, as it turns out. Amen. As you are able, please rise.